The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the newsroom to you live.
Hello, and welcome to Washington Post Live. I'm Robin Gavon, Senior Critic at Large, and my guest today is Ruth Simmons, President of Prairie View A&M University, which is a historically Black college in Prairie View, Texas. Welcome to Washington Post Live, Dr. Simmons.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I thought I would begin by just sort of helping those who are not familiar with HBCUs. If you could just give us a little bit of an overview of why they were founded and the role that they play in the higher education ecosystem.
Well, of course, there are somewhat different histories depending on the institution. Some are private, some are founded by the states. But overall, after slavery and following Reconstruction, some were founded on the idea that something had to be done with these newly freed slaves. To have a livelihood, to be able to take care of themselves, to serve their communities and so forth. I did see in the intro that there's a description of their having been founded to create an equitable education for Blacks. I dare say I don't believe that for a minute. I think they were created by and large to be inferior institutions. They were created in their time to serve the needs of a population that needed everything, absolutely everything. And so thankfully they were founded, and as a consequence of the work that so many people did to keep them alive, to serve the students who came to them, and to build communities, HBCUs have created a wealth of talent and knowledge and provided to the nation leadership across many, many decades that otherwise would perhaps not have been available to the country. So the importance of HBCUs is not to be understated, I would say. Without HBCUs, the country would look very different today, given the deeply segregated communities that persisted over such a long period of time, and the segregated universities that persisted also over such a long time. So I like to say that the nation should express its gratitude to HBCUs for rescuing Blacks basically from a very different kind of existence. If it were not for HBCUs, many communities would not have the professional class that they have today.
I'm really curious when you said that they were in many instances created to be inferior institutions and yet sort of excelled despite that. I mean, would you trace then some of the hurdles that they continue to face, particularly with funding, to those origins?
So let me clarify what I said. I don't want to appear too cynical, but the reality is, at the time that so many of our institutions were founded, ours in 1876, there was no thought whatsoever that Blacks had the ability to perform at a high academic level. It was commonly thought that certain kinds of limited instruction might be available to Blacks, but certainly nowhere near the kind of stimulating intellectual activity and professional training that would exist in a comparable white institution. They were deliberately designed to be separate and quite unequal. In terms of today, what did this different kind of founding and this different set of expectations mean across time? Well, it meant, frankly, that some were founded as very narrow technical schools, because Blacks were good with their hands and they were good with labor, and perhaps something should be tailored to those kinds of talents. Some were founded as normal schools, essentially, in order to train people who would be able to educate more Blacks. Over time, those fields expanded very slowly because Black communities had all kinds of needs. They needed nurses, for example. I love the Huey Long story about how he managed to get a particular hospital in Louisiana integrated. And he did it very simply by arguing that, well, certainly you wouldn't want our white nurses to be serving Black men patients. So we need to provide Black nurses for these Black men, and so on. So that was the flavor. But in spite of that, and in spite of being supported at a very differential level as institutions, these wonderful institutions kept going. They had the support of their communities. They had the support of graduates, and they had some generous benefactors, like the Rockefellers, for example, in regard to Spelman, who came forward and said, this is something that is important to do, and I want to support this institution. And so my own undergraduate institution, Dillard University, had Rosenwald and Stern, for example, who were very generous to Dillard. These kinds of gifts enabled institutions, private primarily, to keep going for a very long period of time, though it's fair to say they were not able to offer the same level of education as comparable white institutions. Because as you know, education is made up of many parts. It's not just a textbook. It has to do with facilities. It has to do with the kind of instruction that one can receive. It has to do with the preparation of the faculty, and so on. So there are many components to offering a fine education. And I would say that HBCUs, for the most part, up until today, have continued to try to do the same thing with less.
I mean, one of the things that have happened in recent years has been this surge of attention on HBCUs, which has also been accompanied by increased donations and funding, privately, certainly. And I'm curious, because you've talked about the challenges of some of those funds, that they come with strings attached or limitations. Is that still the case, and how much of a detriment is that in the functioning of the institution?
Well, first of all, let me say, it is extraordinary that in this very moment, there is a kind of coalescing of support for HBCUs that certainly I've never seen in my entire career. And it is something that is welcome, but it's very different. So here are some of the elements of the difference. First of all, we're dealing with support that is no longer at the symbolic or token level. For so many years, it was. And so donors, institutions, corporations would make a small gift, symbolic, to an HBCU, and a huge gift to its counterpart institution. They would make a gift with all kinds of strings attached to HBCUs, because after all, could they even manage money And so they wanted to be extra cautious about giving funds to HBCUs because of the sense that perhaps HBCUs wouldn't be able to manage as well. And then, of course, they would make gifts to their counterpart institutions that were generously open to the leadership of the institution in terms of directing the funds. Well, guess what's happening today? First of all, the gifts are larger. That is very welcome. Secondly, many of the gifts come absolutely without strings attached. They come with the proviso that the funds be used in whatever way is needed to strengthen the institution. Now, that does two things. First, it gives some credibility to the fact that they believe that the leadership of HBCUs is capable of adding and subtracting, of allocating resources judiciously, and of doing all the things that their counterparts and white institutions can do. So that endorsement is very welcome and long overdue. And secondly, the idea that that we are no longer having to funnel funds into things that we don't need. That's the part that was troubling about the previous era, is we'd be given funds that were welcome in one sense, but not for the most important things that we needed funds for. And so this is an era unlike any that most of us have seen, and we are very grateful for it and very intent on using the resources in the best way possible to improve on what we're able to do for our students.
When you assess the interest in HBCUs, I mean, what do you attribute it to? Is it cultural shifts, the racial justice protests over the last few years, the ability of the schools themselves to better advocate for themselves, a different group of citizens who have the wealth that they can even contribute to an HBCU? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it all of those things, or
it may be a good many of them? But let me say that there is no question that in our country today, we are reckoning with the fact that life in this country for certain groups has not improved to the extent that we thought. That was a pretty rude awakening after the Floyd murder, to say to ourselves, you mean that we spent all this time going through civil rights, having executive orders for affirmative action, having national programs to improve access, and you mean we're no farther along than this? I think what that caused us to do, all of us, blacks, whites, everybody, is to say, let's go back and think about the assumptions we made before, and the kind of plans enacted. Perhaps we should go more directly to the problem and see if there are things that we can do that would have more immediate effect and quite possibly more lasting effect. Well, I mean, you can't get anything more lasting and more a better proof point than HBCUs. Look how long they've existed. Look how long they've been doing the same thing. Look how long they've been overachieving in the face of tremendous barriers. And so the outperformance of HBCUs, I think, came more into focus. And the difficulties, I should say, with regard to other institutions also came more into focus. And that is that not enough progress has been made by other types of institutions with regard to access and equality. So I think it is the justice movement for sure that caused us to look again. Let me say that at my age and having been a child of the civil rights struggle, I'm embarrassed to say how surprised I was to learn that things had not progressed nearly to the degree that we had hoped back in the 60s. I'm surprised by how naive I was to think that because particular paragons had succeeded, that we too easily assumed that the problem, so to speak, was fixed. The fact that one person becomes an Ivy League president means nothing, really. It just means that one person did. It doesn't mean that problems are solved for all time just because we've had some successes with some people being able to get over those hurdles. So now we're going back and doing the groundwork that is so essential, and that is trying to understand the ways in which HBCUs put together a program with all of the difficulties they had that succeeded in getting a Thurgood Marshall to be the leader that he was, that it succeeded in all of the people. One of the greatest writers of our period, Toni Morrison. How does Howard University produce a Toni Morrison? And so now we're looking at that and saying, okay, well, our thoughts about how education works may be a little too primitive. Maybe we're not taking adequate consideration of all of the other parameters that contribute to people being productive citizens, being confident in who they are, being able to be a force for good in the country. Maybe we're doing the work that we should have done long ago.
Just to remind viewers that you were the first Black person to lead an Ivy League institution when you were the president of Brown. And one of the things that you brought up is that our focus on individual achievement as opposed to the broader, and I'm going to use the word systemic intentionally, because I mean, it sounds like you are really pointing to the issues of systemic racial inequity. And that has become a really sort of contentious point of conversation, because it leads people down that path of critical race theory. And are you saying that the entire structure of the country is racist? I mean, how do you, as an academic, as a leader, take the country through what is clearly a challenging, difficult territory?
Well, I'm working with a wonderful group here in Houston, a group of business leaders, and we're working on the issue of diversity and inclusion. And when I first approached this group to talk to them about how we could work together, I emphasized that there's no shame in looking at where we are, discovering that we're not where we thought we were, and then deciding, let's take on the challenge of trying to redesign what we're doing. After all, on an ongoing basis, businesses do that all the time, communities do that all the time, universities do it all the time. People are so fond of strategic planning, right? Let's look at our country and ask ourselves whether or not, if we project forward, as we should have during the civil rights movement, if we project forward, what are the kinds of things that need to be emphasized in order for us to have the kind of satisfying relationships that we want to have as citizens of this country? What are the things that matter? Well, we now know that what matters in part is that inclusion has risen to the top in a way it was not present before. And why is that? Because the way in which we value each other, the way in which we respect each other, these have become factors that we are now looking at and understanding how important they actually are. At first, we concentrated on, well, what's the degree that you have, and do you go to school, and do you get the right degree, and then when you do that, how are you performing, and so forth. We concentrated on all those factors, which were good, but we left something out critical, and that is, you can be the smartest person in the world, and people can still discriminate against you. And so you've got to go back to the root cause and ask yourself, how can we learn as human beings, all of us together, to be the kind of country where people feel valued? That's the nub of it to me. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's very exciting, because I've lived through all of the other parts of it. You know, I grew up in a deeply segregated South, where my parents couldn't go in front doors, where my mother worked as a maid because that was the only job that she could get, where they never felt the respect of the communities that they were a part of. I lived through that. And so I know how much it matters to people that they are valued, that they are respected. And I think the movement we're on now is all about that, to be perfectly honest with you. Yes, equality of opportunity, equality of benefits. We live in a world where health disparities has extraordinary consequences for underserved communities. That's a real problem. But if you stepped into any of those communities and you ask about what it feels like on a day-to-day basis to be a part of this country, they will say how much they value being treated with respect. So I actually love the place we are now. I think of all the people who are citing critical race theory and so forth, I think they're running for cover. I think they don't understand what it is. I think it's one of those catchwords that you find when you're looking for a way to try to evade the real issues that are at hand. And I don't care whether people talk about critical race theory. That's of little consequence to me. What I care about is whether or not they're talking about these children and whether or not they're going to get a fair chance. Every child, I don't care, Black, Hispanic, white, doesn't matter. Okay, are they going to, when they are born, will we see them as having a fair chance of living the life that they should live? That's the nub of it. And anybody who wants to bring in theories that distract us from that, let them bring in those theories. But we must not be distracted from the fundamental question.
And do you find that the generation now that is really raising its voice and is sort of arguing against incrementalism, do you look to that as a sign of progress and hope? Are you cheered by that?
Well, it's hard. You know, I'm old. And so I don't want to impose my judgment on young people who are living their lives and trying to do what they think is best to have the future that they deserve. So I'm not going to second guess what they're doing. But here's what I do think is very important. What's important is that they care, and that they're actively looking for ways to improve upon the lives of so many people in our country. What can be wrong with that? They may go about it in a different way. And sometimes, you know, I chastise my students all the time, because if they come into my office and they say something that I think is weird or is off base, I challenge them right away. And I say, I was talking to a student who was sending me text messages with all kinds of cryptic things in it, and so I stopped and decided to lecture him about what it's like to be an older person and to be getting text messages the way he's sending them. And so why is it that, I don't want to go Rodney King on you, but why is it that we cannot just try to work harder at communicating with each other? Okay, I don't want to have to go and text the way my students text, because that's their mode of communication. And I don't want them to feel that they are saddled with all of the restrictions that I was saddled with when I was coming along at their age. I think a coming together and talking about these issues and working it out. And that's the reason that we set up something called an activist in residence in our center here. because we want to, we don't want to just complain about the way young people go about things. We want to give them examples of ways that change has come about in the past through the passion and persistence of individuals, because they're going to create their own path. It's better for us to give them examples than to watch them create things that have been done before, only to stumble and then delay progress. So I believe very much in offering examples to young people, but not stifling what they do. The future is theirs. It's not ours.
Well, I think on that optimistic note, we are going to have to end because we are terrible. I'm terrible, sad to report, out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you.
Those who are watching, if you're interested in more Washington Post Live programming, please go to WashingtonPostLive.com and register for upcoming events. I'm Robin Gavon. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for listening. For more information on our upcoming programs, go to WashingtonPostLive.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.